Duck, duck, goose! The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
In this episode of the Duck of Minerva podcast, I interview Janice Bialy-Matern, who is an associate professor of political science at the National University of Singapore. Among her many works is Ordering International Politics, Identity Crisis and Representational Force, which was published by Routledge in 2005. This is Dan Nexon, and I have on the line all the way from Singapore, Janice Bialy-Matern. Janice, are you there?
Hello, Dan. I'm here.
Thank you so much for agreeing to record an interview today. I know that with the time difference, it's quite late there, that we had some issues with getting my schedule to align with yours. So I'm really super psyched.
Thank you so much. It's good to talk to you.
So I always ask, and it's getting boring by this point for our listeners to hear me say it, but I always start out by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself.
A little bit about myself, my intellectual background, I assume. I sort of backed into academia. I started with a pretty vague interest in comparative politics and development. Not sure that when I started that I knew what that meant. And so I went to Yale, where I could work with Jim Scott, and he's wonderful. And as soon as I started taking classes with him, I realized that I had no idea what the connection was between his marvelous work and what interested me. I see a much deeper connection now, but at the time I didn't. And at the time that I was realizing I wasn't connecting very well to the material in comparative politics and agrarian development, I happened to be taking Alex Wendt's seminar in international relations theory, The Core Requirement, and I had an epiphany. And the strange thing about that epiphany, of course, is that I can't really say that I connected to that material either. Bombs and rockets and balances of power and managing balances of power, which was what it was all about back in that day, doesn't seem deeply personal to me either. Although I did actually grow up in a Pacific island where nuclear weapons technology was being developed, and it was during the Cold War. So retrospectively, I think that the human dimension of that has had an impact on the way that I think and what interested me. But I think that what happened during that seminar and why I sort of went in the direction away from more empirical comparative work was that this was probably my first contact with explanatory theory. That's a little bit surprising to think that I had come all the way through university, spent 2 years doing other things, gone to grad school, and only ever encountered normative theory. And it was a very clarifying experience for me. It sort of helped me figure out what it was that had been interesting me about development from a comparative perspective. And it ended up being the clarity of the ideas that was more mobilizing for me than the study of the actual events themselves. And I realized that politically, what I'm interested in has been very much the same over time. It just took me being in a theory class to be able to put words to that. So my background is the background of someone who stumbles in and then all of a sudden it becomes clear. And I guess I would say that the things that interest me most have to do with the connection between the micro level processes and macro level logics of social life. But what makes it political And this is part of what became clear to me in that theory seminar so long ago, is that I'm interested in a multiplicity of forms and shapes of power and how it operates in that transition from micro to macro. But then I guess the sort of third dimension of that, and the part that has really animated where I've gone since those early days in graduate school, is that I'm interested in things that people think don't matter. That's a primary interest of mine politically. Things that people think don't matter, either because they feel they're fundamentally obvious what the relevance of something is, or because it's been defined out of the domain of what counts as important. And I guess that has been the background for me, is coming to understand through a whole bunch of sort of accidents and coincidences and false starts that I care about what doesn't matter and the politics of why it doesn't matter, and making political the story about why it does matter. So that's sort of where I'm coming from, and it's a big, broad conceptual framework, but I think that that's exactly what my work has been about taking concepts and making them more political.
Would you provide some examples?
Sure. Let's see. Well, I suppose my first project was an examination into what I would say the absolutely unimportant case of how the U.S. and Britain worked out disputes among themselves over the Suez Crisis. When most people study the Suez Crisis, what they're interested in is what happened to make it possible for there to be the kind of collusion that happened. Why the U.S. and Britain got into the tiff that they got into in the first place. But there never seemed to be a question about how exactly it was that that got resolved. It seemed obvious, and I still often get this question, how is this puzzling? The question being, how is it puzzling that this rupture was repaired? The U.S. is simply more powerful. Britain needed the U.S., and that's the end of the story. But that strikes me as simply wrong, because there's a whole series of dynamics in that relationship, neglected dynamics that emerge from the character of that relationship that take us down to a deeper micro level, allow us to see different kinds of power operating. In that case, the argument that I made was that the power that was operating was what I would call language power, the way in which words get used and strung together in particular kinds of sentence formations to express power that entrap people. But seeing that process makes political something that we could otherwise bracket, move on, and study a larger picture about something more obvious. And I think that this, in some cases, or I'm sorry, in some sense, this focus on the Suez Crisis is not the natural location for this kind of question, and that's exactly why I was drawn to it, because it just seemed so obvious. What I'm working on now is another example of things that don't matter because they seem so obvious, but it's much less traditional in IR. And here I'm thinking about the fact that while I was looking at the Suez Crisis and the way the security community was repaired through various forms of language power that people had neglected, it's fairly commonplace in IR to sit down and look at a couple of states and how they worked things out. But when it comes to what I'm doing now, we basically make the argument we don't need to look at how states negotiate or manage or deal with non-state actors. So the current project is actually an examination of transnational crime networks as transnational crime networks, which don't matter in the traditional formulation of international relations because they are factors that impinge on states rather than sites of politics in their own right, or that's the way it gets represented. So we need to understand them in the same way that we need to understand terrorists, for instance, because we need to know what their motivations are. We need to know what to expect of them so that states can manage their relationships with each other and manage their own internal dynamics in a way that is protected from the exigencies of these kinds of actors. But that seems to me to get it backwards and wrong. Because if you start from the idea that we look at violence in the international system as a completely normal thing that is a result of the international system, and we look at it only as happening among states. We recognize other forms of violence, of course, in the international system, but we never think of the system as being the cause of it. And so things like transnational crime networks or terrorists get treated slightly differently. They're outside the system, they're sources of violence, but the reason for their violence has nothing to do with the system itself. And so this project is stepping outside of this, looking at the relations between states and trying to ask the question, what kind of an international system is producing the kind of violence that transnational crime networks are engaged in at the current time? And that is a form of violence that in itself is curious, because it doesn't follow from the motivations of what we take to be the motivations of transnational crime networks. Transnational crime networks, unlike terrorist networks, engage in violence that seems to have no political function and that it's economically irrational. So even if we wanted to go about this by explaining it in terms of the motivations of these idiosyncratic actors that impinge upon the system, we can't. So looking at the system itself as the source of the violence puts a different spin on it. And so in this regard, I'm still looking at things that don't matter, but I'm looking at things that don't matter this time because they've been defined out of the system.
We had a chance to talk at various times about this project as it's evolved when I've seen you at conferences and stuff, and I'm not sure that I know where it currently is. But I must say that the research you've done for this has been just fascinating, and I thought that it would be fun to have you talk a little bit about that research.
Well, the project started very much as my intellectual history did, by backing into it. When I was at Temple University, which was my first tenure track position, in about 2003, it just so happened that I met a criminologist who really caught my interest. Temple has a fabulous criminology department. And he was studying transnational crime, which was not hip or interesting in 2003, or it was just starting to become so. And he was telling me just how terribly difficult it is to get data on transnational crime. And I thought, well, that's just a provocation. It just happens then that a couple of weeks later, I was reading the newspaper and saw that Fabio Ochoa, who was the leader of one of the sub-rings within all the Colombian cocaine trafficking cartel, which is neither Colombian nor a cartel, but that's neither here nor there, that he had been arrested and put to trial in the United States and had been found guilty and was about to make an appeal. But reported in this article was also the fact that there had been 1,500 hours of wiretapped evidence presented in the course of the trial. And the provocation from my colleague in the criminology department was stimulating enough to me that I decided to call the defense attorney and find out if I could listen to some of that. And I should say here, I had absolutely no background in transnational crime and had never thought about it before, but the idea of listening to 1,500 hours or even 5 hours of wiretap phone conversations among Colombian, Mexican, Paraguayan, Bolivian, American cocaine traffickers is just fascinating, especially for someone who's spent a lot of time doing discourse analysis. And I would just call it sheer beginner's luck, but the defense attorney said yes. He invited me down to Florida. I went and I collected about 500 hours. And I started listening to them in 2003, which it's embarrassing to say how long ago that is. but I began listening to them, which was difficult because it's in very difficult Spanish. And after about a year, with a lot of other interventions in between, I realized that there was something going on there that was worth paying attention to. So I went back and tried to get the rest of the data, and that's another story altogether, having to do with freedom of information and interesting bureaucratic ellipses. It turns out the information that I have, I actually hold illegally, although the government, once they realized that I had it, thought that the right thing to do was to give the rest of it to me and give me permission to use it rather than to try to extract it from me. So I now hold it legally, but that first 500 hours that I got was a pure accident. Anyway, so that's how this all started, and it took me years and years to figure out what to do with the information. But the thing that struck me most in listening to this is this understudied phenomenon of international, what I'm calling international public violence. And what I mean by international public violence is chopping off heads of border guards and dumping them on embassy steps, or burning tons and tons of cocaine at the front gates of a training facility for joint U.S.-Mexican policing exercises. Things that take aim at symbols of international authority. And this is just not talked about. We hear an awful lot about how Mexican cocaine traffickers behead civilians. We hear an awful lot about the kinds of random violence, bus burnings and kidnappings and bribery and corruption in Mexico, in El Salvador. But what we're not hearing, and what came clear to me in listening to these tapes over time, is that there's a whole other dimension to this violence. I suppose it's not surprising that it's not reported, but it is violence that is directly against the policers. And when I mean the policers, I mean the symbols of sovereign authority that are trying to get control over the kinds of economic activities, illicit economic activities that these networks are engaged in.
So how do you make sense of that? Because it seems to me the sort of common answer, or the standard answer, would be, well, you know, these are criminal organizations that are trying to demonstrate to the powers that be that they are outside their control, that they can inflict violence upon them with impunity, and it's a sort of part of a struggle over law enforcement and criminality. But it sounds like there's something more to it in the way that you understand these kinds of acts.
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that it makes absolutely no sense to try to demonstrate your impunity when demonstrating your impunity, if you're a profit-seeking organization, means bringing down even more robust policing on yourself. So if you approach this from a sort of rationalist, we're thumbing our nose at authorities so that we can show them get off our backs, it doesn't work that way. Now, thumbing your nose at authority, that's interesting, right? This is exactly the question. Why would you thumb your nose at authority? Why would you show them that you are beyond their reach, tempting a kind of crackdown if the whole point of the organization is the pursuit of illicit profit, right? So it's utterly counterproductive, given what we think transnational crime networks are. And this goes back to the thing that bothers me about IR, the way transnational crime has been handled in IR. We have this idea that transnational crime networks are profit-seeking organizations, right? And once we get that idea, then we can just go ahead and analyze everything that happens with them, whatever they're doing, whatever profits they're making, however they're reorganizing, whatever profits they're not making, however long their jail sentence are, whatever happens, is reducible to this self-perpetuating logic of rationality that has to do with being a criminal that's pursuing profit. But the very idea, thumbing your nose while you're risking precisely the kind of crackdown that you're demonstrating, that you're trying to demonstrate that you're immune from, is completely counterproductive for the process of efficient, adaptive, network-based profit-seeking. So right? I mean, these people aren't stupid. They're aware that they're getting policed increasingly with everything that they do. And so if our models are proper about this, if there's something right, if they're going to get traction, then what we would really expect to see them do is fly below the radar screen. We'd expect bribery. We expect corruption. We expect back alley killings of officials, but we expect it quietly. And we certainly don't want, we would certainly not expect it in big symbolic shows against international authorities. And when I say international, I mean authorities that represent collaborative operations, collaborative policing operations between countries, right? Because even if Mexico doesn't have the wherewithal to crack down in any meaningful way against this show of impunity or thumbing nose at authority, the fact that Mexico is working with the United States in whatever conflicted and fractured way to police the particular network that I'm thinking of right now is already, an assurance that there is enough wherewithal to crack back down, right? So Mexico may be too weak to do anything about it, but we're backed by U.S. power. That's certainly not the case. So the standard story to me, in order to work, has to stretch beyond what is meaningful in relation to how we understand the purpose of these organizations. So it raises the question, what is the purpose of these organizations? And often when I raise that question, the reply that I get is, well, that's a question for criminologists and sociologists, not IR. To which my answer is, but wait a minute, right? If we keep operating with an understanding of these organizations as completely static, then what we're doing is we're depriving ourselves of understanding a site of politics that's happening here, or at least understanding the full dimensions of it. And so starting by asking, what is it about the system, the broader international system within which these transnational crime networks operate? What is it about the relationships that constitute that system that make it possible for this kind of violence to make sense for transnational crime networks?
So what is the answer that you've arrived at so far?
Yeah, well, the answer has to do with emotion. And the reason I've arrived at this answer comes effectively from asking myself, well, what kind of a system is it? If we're going to try to ask the question, what kind of a system makes possible this form of violence, we need to be able to say something about the kind of system that it is. That system, of course, we could characterize as an anarchy among states, and maybe that's true, but it's also so much more than that. And so there's been this big hunk of development in this project of digging into the conception of a system of hierarchies, overlapping integrated hierarchies. And the interesting part about hierarchies, of course, is that hierarchies, and your work, by the way, Dan, is a testament to this, or an example of this, and it figures in my argument in many ways.
I'm blushing now, but go on.
Can't see the podcast, but the thing about hierarchies is that even if they're relatively durable, they also invite resistance to their very logic. Right? This is just one of the characteristics of hierarchies, and this is all the more so when you have a system of intertwined, interconnected, sometimes conflicting hierarchies, in which actors are positioned in multiple hierarchies at once, and so there are contradictions and leakages and so on. But the problem is that we don't really have a good understanding of exactly why it is, when it is, and how it is that hierarchies, especially interlocking hierarchies, produce the kind of resistance that they produce and why. And so if you read carefully into a lot of the literature on hierarchy, it does a couple of things. It either assumes that subordinates are always already waiting to rebel, that there's always already a conflict of interests. And I don't doubt that that may be the case in some instances, but this just can't be the case with transnational crime networks because they're parasitic on the very hierarchies that they're resisting in this case, and they're quite conscious of that. And that's one of the things that I've learned in a sort of evidence-based fashion from listening to these tapes. And that's another thing. It's alarming the extent of self-consciousness that that the people that I've had the chance to listen to have about the structure of power relations that they're embedded in. So the question is, how does it become possible for hierarchies to produce this kind of resistance, especially for people that are dependent upon it? And so I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about questions of identity. That's where this project started, and it of course is my default mode since it's where I began with my first book. It was very much about identity and the politics of identity, but it just doesn't work in this case. Identity among transnational participants in transnational crime networks is very hard to make stick, either empirically or theoretically. But if you read the work on hierarchy carefully, especially work on hierarchy that is not assuming resistant agents as a precondition for what they're trying to explain, the language of emotion is invoked regularly. And so that provoked my interest in thinking about this. So in addition to slogging through 1,500 hours of wiretap phone conversations, part of what's taking a lot of intellectual energy with this book is figuring out emotions, how they work, and how they create forms of agency that facilitate resistance in a dynamic situation where you're parasitic on, dependent upon that which you're resisting. So that's led me in a psychoanalytic path, and I think I'll stop there for now on that because I'm still sort of working through that. But I have invested some time in conceptualizing how one would study emotion, and so I have a piece out in Emmanuel Adler and Vincent Puyo's edited volume on practices that develops a practice theory of emotion. And that's what's been able to make this an empirical project as well.
That's an interesting connection to draw. And obviously, you know, it's a good thing because it's a really interesting piece in a volume that's turning out to be fairly influential. But it's an interesting connection to draw, not only because we had Vincent on last week, but also because one of the things that I was thinking about when I was thinking about what kinds of questions I was going to ask you had to do with, you know, the kind of influence vectors of your work. I don't have a good, pithy phrase for what I'm about to kind of suggest, but one of the things that I find really interesting about your work is that it's been highly influential in a number of kind of developing projects over the last 10 or 15 years, right? So your work is appropriate, and particularly the early work, your dissertation work and your book. And we should mention that your dissertation was an award-winning dissertation, and the book's very well cited. And I've taught the first book in my advanced IR theory seminar, and the students always really like it. But your work has sort of had a series of influences into developing projects and turns and approaches in IR without ever really being defined by any of them, right? So your work's been very important to practice turn theorists, right, as one of the kind of early seminal pieces that they draw upon in international relations. Your work's been important to those of us who are doing kind of relational turn IR in terms of the way in which you treat discourse analysis as a way of getting into very dynamic relational components of identity. Your work's been very important for linguistic turn constructivists, or linguistic turn scholars who might not even call themselves constructivists anymore, or maybe rejected the label to begin with, who are interested in it for its post-structuralist and post-modernist components. And your work's also been influential in kind of more mainstream work on international order building and on hegemony, where it's been cited in the context of kind of, you know, the Charlie Kupchan, John Eikenberry work on liberal order and on transitions and stuff like that. And that's a really kind of unusually broad variety of influences. I mean, it's one thing to write something that gets critiqued in a variety of different literatures, right, becomes a kind of straw man or straw person argument. But it's another thing to kind of have these a kind of such an important role in such a different variety of works. Do you have any sense of what it is about, particularly kind of the first half of your body of work, the stuff that came before the work that you're currently working on, that meant that it had this kind of disparate impact?
Well, wow, thank you, Dan. I wasn't aware that, I wasn't aware of all of that, and it's really flattering. Actually, what makes it so flattering is that I've always viewed the diversity of influences on my work, and so the sort of multiple possibilities entailed in my work as a professional problem for me, in the sense that I'm not easy to put in a place, and I don't have nothing I write has one single message. And if it does, it's because it came after I wrote something that had many, many more messages and many, many more implications. And then I had a moment of clarity where I could narrow it down into something in particular. But I would say, this, I think that, part of the reason my work has seeds of so many different components in it that I'm glad to know get used in different domains in productive ways by people is because a lot of the work is, in some regards, about trying to figure out how to get back to thinking about human experience as a part of world politics. I never knew how to do that. And each step I've gone, I've gone a little closer to that. So for instance, I mentioned earlier that I grew up in Micronesia during the Cold War, with my father who is a very gifted electrical engineer who was designing what we used to call the technology for Star Wars. It was an experience of living behind barbed wire and playing on missiles and old defunct ones and encountering with people who had absolutely no interest in having us there, and thinking that world politics was about those kinds of human relations. And then realizing in this weird moment of theory and encountering explanatory theory that abstractions actually somehow make it more possible for me to imagine those connections. But the process of moving from those abstractions back down to concrete work that can requires bringing a lot of different pieces in. And so like the shift from identity and relationalism to emotion and the human being, which is, I guess, the way I would talk about what I'm doing now. I mean, my unit of analysis is the experience of being human, has really been what's been going on here, trying to figure out how to construct a project in a way that allows me to think about the world and explain things out there in the world that draws on human experience. And I think I got quite far away from it in that first book, partly because it was the product of a dissertation, and I'm getting closer back to it now. But I guess I would say that if anything, the reason why there's so much going on in my work is because it takes so much effort to get from what we as IR theorists do as our standard course of action to what I think ultimately I meant to be doing when I got into this business. So for a project to get satisfying for me, it has to get close enough to touching on what I consider to be human experience, which requires somehow a lot more layers. Now, I'm not sure how that answers your question, except to say that there's a lot of complexity in the way I think about it. And so I guess it shouldn't be so surprising that there's a lot of complexity in or a multiplicity of possibilities for how it can get used. Did I even answer you? I can't even remember your question at this point.
No, I think you answered it. And I think in doing so, you raised a couple of interesting points. I mean, one is the kind of this you alluded to there being kind of a disciplinary perspective, a kind of dark side to this, which is that, you know, you can have work, you know, kind of valences of your work that are picked up by a variety of different people, right, and deployed by a variety of different people, and that influence a variety of different people in a variety of different kind of research and academic projects. But one of the downsides of that is that, you know, you yourself may not establish a kind of identity as the leader of a particular research movement. And I know that's something that you actually not only, I don't think it bothers you that hasn't happened, but I think you're actually, you kind of embrace that, right? You seem to be pleased by the fact that you've never wound up being Janice Bialy Matern who does X. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, if somebody woke up one day and said, oh, she's the such and such person, I'm not sure it would upset me. Mm-hmm. But I guess, for me, the biggest thrill in all of this is putting ideas together in a way that's unusual. And so it's not that I am purposely staking out a position that says I don't want to be known as X or Y or Z. It's that, so I wouldn't say I take explicit joy in it, but it follows naturally for me. Mm-hmm. That I wouldn't be that easy to pigeonhole in that way. But on the other hand, I guess I would say, now I have about six different lines of thought going on. Let me just say that in my own work and in my own mind, there's a huge continuity between what I've done in the past and what I'm doing now. And it surprises me when I am often approached, especially by graduate students, who have somehow just been assigned my book and then happened to hear me speak on something maybe at ISA related to my current project and say, oh my God, you've gone from identity to emotion, from narratology to the body. Isn't that a huge switch? And then that's the moment where I'm reminded, oh yeah, the profession has this idea that you do this or you do that or you do something else. I guess I haven't had that. I have had this sense in which I am trying to figure something out and I'm following whatever complex of ideas get me there. And to me, the trajectory from a narratological to an affective embodied approach makes perfect sense. But those kinds of encounters remind me that I am operating on a different model, I think, than especially what we're taught to do in graduate school. It's not that I necessarily take great joy in being hard and down. It's just that it makes sense to me why I'm not.
Well, that also gets into the sort of second dimension of this, which is something that we've talked about at times, or something that I think we've sort of played around with, and I remember this, and you know, maybe you don't. So I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot. But is that? For those of you who don't know, I just flew back from Berkeley last night, and that's nothing compared to coming back, you know, across the Pacific or something. I'm still a little jet lagged. But what I was going to say was that one of the things that what you've just said raises is that one of the things that we have talked about on occasion is how a major division in the practice of the field, or being an international relations scholar, a major source of division that we don't really talk about because it doesn't align neatly with the isms or methodology per se, are kind of styles of reasoning, right? Mm. And I think that, you know, so you really kind of follow a style of reasoning where when you want to, you find a set of phenomena that really interest you, and you set about trying to kind of unpack what is that phenomena, what is its ontology, how would we understand it, how would we make sense of it, what kind of theories or theoretical frameworks or literatures do we need to draw upon to make sense of the way that we are conceptualizing that phenomena in a way that gets at that phenomena. So it's a very kind of longer, more reflexive style of reasoning in your work, right, which leads to it having all these kind of rich elements and this level of complexity that sometimes we're told to steer away from, right? So there's a style of reasoning there which, you know, you sort of have done a nice job of narrating for us that begins in this, you know, in the example of your current work with listening to some wiretaps and saying, this is really odd and unusual and it doesn't really fit in our framework. So what kind of framework would make sense of this and where is that going to lead me? And it leads you down a whole set of complicated and interesting intellectual paths. And that's very different from styles of reasoning which take a phenomena and say, okay, well, I've got a toolkit, and I'm going to use that toolkit, whether that be methodological or whether it be theoretical, and I'm going to cut into it with that toolkit, and I'm going to come up with a good explanation for that. And those styles of reasoning really do, I think, differentiate people in the field much more than just what your theoretical commitments are. You know, and it has to do, I think, to some degree of what you consider settled and what you consider unsettled.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you use those words because I think that that is my intellectual style, is to unsettle everything and start from the very beginning. But the short way I put it is I am old school, you know. you're absolutely right. This form of reasoning thing is different. And I do think that there is something old school about my form of reasoning. And I say with some pride. I don't apologize for that. I have a lot of respect for what I would then call new school. But I'm not sure I'm capable of that. And so when it comes to just thinking about the discipline I guess in some regard, I feel lucky that there's still a place for old school. There are days, I think we've all had them, where we wonder about how much longer, I shouldn't say we all. I should say old school people, as I'm meaning it here, wonder how much longer we have. There's a cost to being old school, right? You don't publish an article a year, no less two. If you're lucky, it gets legs, but it's a high risk. It is a high risk when you think about this as a profession rather than a vocation. I find it encouraging that there is still room for old school. But I'm actually, if I have a question for you, because I am no longer in the United States, and one of the reasons I wasn't comfortable in the United States anymore was because I didn't feel like there was a lot of room for the kind of slow, going back to the origins, unsettling things, puzzling through, and then coming out the other end with a study of something substantive and empirical, right? I felt uncomfortable in that environment and wanted to be somewhere where there was still room and time to be this way. But I'm wondering if you can now answer a question for me, if that's not presumptuous. Is there room in the U.S. for this still, this kind of mode of reasoning?
I don't know. And one of the reasons why I fixated on that aspect of what you were telling us and tried to draw it out even further is just listening to you talk about how you've approached this project and listen to you also talk about how there are things you haven't resolved yet. You haven't, you know, come to a conclusion about how exactly you understand the bottom line arguments. Made me really think back to this ongoing discussion that showed up in some of the podcasts and which I've been writing about and which I was just presenting out at Berkeley, which is this question of, quote unquote, the end of IR theory, right? Yeah. And I'm wondering if what were people who are, you know, so clearly, you know, the paradigms are becoming passe, and clearly there isn't the room for kind of writing, you know, I read a social theorist, now I'm going to explicate that social theorist's implications for IR. You know, that stuff doesn't show up in IO very much anymore, maybe for better. But I do think that maybe what is at the core of what people like me who are worried about the passing of robust international theorizing or worried that there's something wrong with the state of international theorizing right now might not be better expressed through what you've just kind of asked me, right? Which is whether there's a certain style of reasoning which is, you know, slow boring in many ways, but which is always empirical in terms of its orientation, right? We're not doing theory for theory's sake. We're building a theoretical apparatus, a theoretical prosthetic to figure out something about the world, which is definitely what you do, right? That's what we're kind of worried about disappearing. Right, is because that kind of process is what produces novel ways of thinking about the world, which produces new bodies of theories that we can then pursue and approach. And so maybe when we talk about the end of international theory, it's the diminishing rewards for that kind of style of reasoning, which is both unsettled in its ontology, unsettled in its epistemology, unsettled in its theory, but also at the end of the day, relentlessly oriented towards making sense of the world.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much room there is for that. I mean, I think it's always been a high-risk, high-stakes game, right? Which is that it's a route that if you go on and you succeed, you can do pretty well for yourself. But if you fail, there's not a safety net for, right? At least in North America, or at least in the United States. And I do think it's become harder because of these things that we've talked about, the pressure to publish, professionalization, the increasing ease of doing certain kinds of work because of computing power, et cetera, that lends itself well to producing N+7 out of a single project, and so on and so forth. But it may also be simply that, you know, there aren't a lot of really interesting ideas going on right now. And maybe that's why outside of the United States, the practice turn has caught on so well, is that it feels like at least there's something there that allows for new exploration that also everybody can talk about, as opposed to what had been happening before, which was sort of the fragmentation of 15 different isms and turns within kind of a constructy, post-structurally continental umbrella. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I mean, I don't know. I'm a reluctant practice person, so I hesitate to remark on whether that's creating a lot of openings. For me, it has, primarily because it gave me an opportunity to think about the body, mm-hmm. Connect the body to IR in a way that was systemic, because in the end, I am interested in the system. I don't think it's an international system, by the way, but it's a system, and I'm interested in it. And it's very hard to find a conceptual apparatus that allows you to move across those from the micro to the macro in the way that practice theory does. Maybe you're right. Maybe I do take some pride in not being pinned down because.
Well, every time we've tried to pin you down, you've resisted, right? Every time anybody tries to roll you into a project, you either ultimately, you know, say, you know what, this isn't my project, or you say, I'll do this, but I'm going to do it to my own drum, which is great. That's a good thing. But
I suppose you're right. You know, I mean, I suppose that you're right. And then you do ask yourself that I was joking and probably was hard to hear over the podcast. But here I am writing a book about resistant criminality, right? What kind of a commentary that is, you know, we'll see. But I guess I just, and then this is sort of a shameless self-interest plug, since I just sat here and said how poor I am at the professional game because I'm engaged. I mean, I have been incredibly lucky and had what I feel to be great success doing what I want to do. So it's by no means to be misunderstood as a whine. But as I've just finished saying that I'm not so good at playing the professional part of this game, I do want to then just pause for a minute and say that I'm about to take over with Soo-Yun Kim the editorship of the International Studies Review. And the mandate of that journal is to provide a forum to crystallize new debates, new lines of research, new modes of thinking. And if we say there's not room for old school, I guess one of the appeals for me of editing this journal is that because it is a review journal and because reviews are inevitably where new things begin from, I actually see this as an opportunity to make more space for that kind of thing, make more space for slow thinking that moves through ideas, presenting them in a space that allows for some debate. So, I guess there may not be much room in the United States left to pursue, I suppose, the R1 extremely high profile kind of publishing an IO at every turn path, doing this kind of complex work where you back into it and let it unfold. I guess that's another way I would characterize the way I approach my work. But there are outlets for it, right? And I do think there's more room for it here in Singapore and in some other places. I think it may be changing eventually too. I mean, in the end, we're in a world of you know, productivity and bean counting, but in the meantime, there's some space. And in the meantime, I have a forum. And I guess I'm going to use this now as an opportunity to urge people who are developing new ideas, theoretical ideas, trying to break ground into new debates, trying to synthesize things in different ways, to submit to ISR. It's okay to submit to ISR without knowing how it's going to work out in the end. And I'm referring here to my own sort of refusal to say what the bottom line is yet on my project. I can have all kinds of good work doing productive things that doesn't yet reach conclusions. And so I hope this is an opportunity for people who are inclined to try that out.
Okay. I did mean to, and this is a good opportunity to congratulate you on assuming the editorship and of a journal that I think has really risen in prominence over the last, you know,
current editors.
8 to 10 years. I'm sorry?
Extraordinary job with that journal. And Soo-Yun and I we're just so glad to be picking it up with the momentum that Jennifer Sterling-Folker and Mark Boyer have brought to it. They've done such a great job of really, really putting it out there on the map.
Well, I have no doubt that you two will not only continue that, but increase the momentum. Can you increase the momentum? I don't know. But we're all very excited and congratulations. And I do want to say, you know, again, I can be a little bit fixated sometimes, but I do think the thing about your work that, you know, you sort of talk about it as old school versus new school, but I think it's really important to emphasize that one of the reasons why a lot of people in new school work, quote unquote, get justifiably frustrated with international relations theorizing is the sense that there isn't ultimately a there there, right? That there is no underlying empirical question or problem or puzzle driving that work. And I think that's a completely justified criticism of a large chunk of what happens in international theorizing. And I think it's a reason why some people just got fatigued by it. But I think your work kind of shows that that is often, though not the case, that it's possible to do incredibly complex international theory for the purpose of unpacking some interesting phenomena. And that in that sense, I know that, you know, you may think of, you know, like your current project is a very slow-moving one because of its complexity. But I do think that that's a reason why grad students do seek you out and why grad students do read your work and become very interested in it as a potential kind of model for how to do things, because they see both that there's a lot of intellectual meat and depth and new things going on, but they also recognize that it's not for its own sake. Right, it's not scholasticism of IR theory or something like that.
Yeah, and there is quite a bit of work out there as you describe it. I guess, and for me, ultimately, that wouldn't work. In the end, I need something to hang on to. Right, it needs to be for something. But you know, in that vein, and I would just say that sometimes before you can use something for something, right, before you can use a theory for something, the theory itself needs to be hashed through on its own. This is a question more than a maybe a rhetorical one. I don't know whether we need to wait until the theory is cooked and applied in order for it to be useful and interesting. So while in principle I agree that it can be very frustrating to have theory that is unattached to some empirical phenomenon in the world that you're trying to explain, I also wonder what we're missing by failing to engage that. Just a thought to throw out there.
Well, I mean, as I would say, I know that's rhetorical, but... is that it's a style of reasoning issue, right? Which is another way of saying that I think it matters less what any particular work does. What matters is that, and I think you can tell the difference between work which is driven by, even if it's very abstract or theoretical and doesn't directly impinge on some, you know, attempt to explain an empirical phenomena. Then you can tell the difference between that work when, in fact, it's driven all the time by an engagement with the world, quote unquote, of international politics, and that work when it isn't. And I think that maybe that's the difference. It's not so much what the package is, but it's what's going on to produce that package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. Just to bring things full circle, you started out obviously in North America, and you've alluded to working at Temple, and then you were working at Lehigh, and now you're at Singapore, which has become, and you were an early mover, right, has now become the hot spot for a lot of Americans who've gone over to their work, and also Europeans. So what's it like working in being an academic in Singapore?
It is fabulous for me. I did my graduate work at Yale, which was, you know, in the moment you hate it, you just hate it. And then years later, you look back on it. Oh, I was so lucky. That was the best time. You know? So for me, it was pretty much all downhill in terms of I had some wonderful jobs and wonderful colleagues in the United States throughout, but it was all downhill for me in terms of intellectual space and sort of opportunities to grow as a scholar after grad school. I went from Yale to Dartmouth to on 1 year to Temple for 3 years, and then to Lehigh for 7 years. And I moved here from Lehigh for a whole bunch of reasons that I can promise you are going to be unsatisfying to anybody, because they don't add up. There's no silver bullet. But I will say, I'm not sure I was an early mover. just an early mover in IR. When I got here, there were already a critical mass of incredibly interesting scholars, especially in political theory, which is something that I really missed while I was at Lehigh in a department that was a really interesting department, but an international relations department, which at the time was a great thing in my mind. You get to be doing IR and nothing but IR, but it got narrow very quickly, and I really missed political theorists. And so when I got here, immediately my intellectual space opened up in that regard. But I was an early IR mover. I was drawn in primarily by Terry Narden, who is our head of department and an extraordinary human being and scholar and all kinds of things. But in the first year I was here, we did a ton of searching. And as a result of that search, we have hired a lot of people. And in IR especially, we've grown. Soo-yeon, obviously, Soo-yeon Kim, who is my co-editor, but also was with me at Yale in our PhD program. But William Bain and Ted Hoff have also arrived here this year. And so now we really have a core of IR that is diverse and interesting, and that's just senior faculty, right? We also have great junior colleagues, Terrence Lee, Ian Chong, Karen Wenzowski. So it's a big IR group. And yet it's really different what counts as IR here, and what the boundaries of IR are, so that the comparative and IR slide together much more here than I'm used to in the United States. The absence of American politics seems to make IR take up a lot more space, or I should say IR comparative. And so the dimensions of my intellectual life in a political science department here are just expansive. So that's what it's like for me. It's like intellectual nirvana, and I think the thing about it, part of what makes it so wonderful, is to invoke a metaphor that may or may not work. We are a department that is a zoo and not a herd, and what I mean by that is that not just within IR but across the department in general, no one does the same thing. Although you could say now that Ted has arrived, there's quite a bit of overlap between he and I, at least theoretically. But beyond that, there's no two people that approach things from the same theoretical perspective. We've got modelers, we've got quantitative statistical, we've got constructivist theoreticians, we've got empirical constructivists, we've got security people, we've got Marxists, we have it all, right? And that's what my experience has been here. So in some weird, perverse turn, I would say that this is the most intellectual freedom I have ever had. And that comes as a surprise to people, because there is often this sense that you don't have academic freedom here. For me, I came for the academic freedom.
Well, it sounds like all of the various institutions in Singapore that are engaged in hiring right now outside of Singapore ought to use you as their spokeswoman.
Well, I'm having a great time here. I mean, you know, I'm on this semester as well, so that helps.
Well, of course, it sounds great. The big disappointment for those of us who know you and used to spend a lot of time with you at various kinds of conferences, small and large, is that we don't get to see you enough, right? The draft Janus movements that prop up on Facebook for bringing you out to things, for example. But it sounds like you're really thriving, and it sounds like from what you've been saying, the work is going really well, and it just sounds great. So
yeah, it's great. I urge you all to come visit, and sometimes it's possible for us to participate in making that happen, but sometimes it's not. If you can think of a way to get here, we are always looking for exciting people. That's one thing I just want to say about that. This really is a stopover place for so many people. That in some regards, one of the comments I often get, don't you feel marginalized being on the other side of the world? I suppose that if I had been in an institution like Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, maybe I wouldn't, this wouldn't seem so novel to me, but we get so many people passing through Singapore that I am much more in the thick of things here than I ever was in the U.S. So anyway, if you pass through, if anybody out there passes through, we're always welcoming speakers here, and it's a vibrant community, so I hope you will consider it. Everybody should come here.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much for taking time to get recorded for distribution on the internet, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again sometime soon.
So am I. Thanks, Dan.
Bye. And thus ends Duck of Minerva podcast number 11, recorded on 4 October 2012. Thanks for listening.